Tonight's talk is on the wisdom of the ego. There's a lot of bad things said about the ego. I thought I'd say a few nice things. This relates, of course, to one of the more controversial teachings that causes a lot of consternation among people as Buddhism comes to the West, which is the teaching on not-self. What does it mean? How do you interpret it? There are lots of different interpretations out there. They can be boiled down into different types based on what question people think the answer that this teaching is meant to answer. The one that's most commonly attributed to the Buddha is the question of what are you? Do you have a self? Answering the metaphysical question, does a self exist? Does it not exist? And the various answers that are given there, the one is just plain old no, there's no self. Of course, that gets into a lot of trouble. If there's no self here, what are we doing? Why are we practicing? Why would we do anything to help this thing that is not self? It also doesn't fit in with the teachings on karma. If there's no self, then who does the karma and who's going to receive the teachings on karma? Another interpretation that comes out is that the Buddha is not denying all types of self, but he's denying specific types. One version is that he's denying the universal self that was taught by the Brahmins at the time, but he was saying basically, you do have yourself, but it's just not cosmic. The other version is, well, yes, you have a cosmic self, but you don't have yourself. So that's one set of answers to that question. The idea that self-teaching is basically a metaphysical question, i.e. what is the true nature of what you are as a human being? A second one is that people noticing that the Buddha tended to avoid metaphysical questions, they say it's probably not dealing with a metaphysical issue, it's dealing more with a psychological one. And in this case, the teaching is more often interpreted as not so much no self, but as no ego. And why would the Buddha teach you to have no ego? Well, basically to have you let go and to kind of go with the flow. A third version basically puts the two together, saying the Buddha was saying that there is no individual self or no separate self, but there is a universal self, and it's your little ego that's getting in the way of your realizing the universal self. So you should learn how to let go of your ego and go with the flow of the universal self. Tonight, I would like to focus on this issue of ego. To what extent was the Buddha actually talking about ego in the way that we think about it in the West? There are a couple of problems here with the teaching on the ego. On the one hand, there are some people who really like this teaching, saying, oh, we have no ego. And then they go on to use that as an excuse. Well, in that case, we don't really have to practice. Because if you try to practice and try to create concentration and try to do right effort to get rid of unskillful thoughts and develop skillful ones, you've got to have an ego in order to do that. So we just say you don't have an ego, and that sort of cuts the responsibility off there, which is not really helpful for the practice. There's another approach, which is that both in Western psychology based on Freud and that based on Jung, the ego has a very essential role to play. Without your ego, you would not be able to sort of exert your will. You'd be just kind of run over by other people. And so they're kind of concerned that what is this teaching that there is no ego? There's a field of modern psychology that is drawn both on Freud and Jung on the one hand and on Buddhism on the other. And they think they've come up with a new discovery, which is that you actually need a healthy ego before you can let go of your ego. And so you have to develop the healthy ego first, and then you can let go of the ego and kind of go with the flow of the universal self. So those are some of the positions that are out there. What I'd like to point out, though, is that healthy ego functioning is something that the Buddha actually taught. But to back up a little bit, you have to ask yourself, was the Buddha kind of person who himself, you look at his biography, was the kind of person who would just kind of go with the flow? And you hear stories about the Buddha going out and undergoing 6 years of torture, self-torture, basically, and then sitting under the tree and saying, okay, I'm not going to get up. After he realized that self-torture was the wrong way, then he sat under the tree and finally said, okay, I'm not going to get up from the tree. And my blood can dry up and my flesh can go dry. But I'm not going to get up until I've reached the deathless happiness. Now, that's not a kind of a meek, no ego, go with the flow kind of person. He was actually trying to find something that other people were saying was totally impossible. and you look at the way he actually taught this, his teaching on not self, to begin with, he was not answering the question of what you are. It was a question he always put aside. He said, you ask this question of what you are, you get entangled in views, and it's not going to help you at all to put an end to suffering, which was the goal of his teaching. Instead, he was teaching not self as more of a strategy for how do you let go of clinging, because clinging is one of the things that stands in the way of the end of suffering. And one of our major clingings is our clinging to our sense of who we are, what we are. So instead of asking you to say there, you know, come to the conclusion that there is no self, he would simply take you through a list of things that you might possibly identify with as yourself and get you so you can see that ultimately this is not worth holding on to. And you see, this is not self, this is not worthy of being self, that's not worthy of being self. It's a value judgment, not a metaphysical judgment. Is this worth going through the activity of holding on here? In other words, he has you see self as a kind of action. And so when is it, when you're holding on to this particular action, he says it's going to be suffering. However, he says you don't let go of all of your sense of self all at once. You go chip away at it sort of bit by bit, first starting with unskillful ways of identifying. Because if you think about it, as you go through the day, your identity changes quite a bit. You know, if you decide that you want some cheesecake, you know, your identity as a father and a mother might just be put aside at that time. I want some cheesecake. And now all of a sudden, you're the cheesecake desirer. And you're going to go out. Okay, where, do I have enough money for cheesecake? Where is the best cheesecake in Victoria? And that's what matters. And then, okay, you've got your cheesecake, and then you remember, oh, I've got some responsibilities back home, I better go back home. And then you take on another identity. We go through many identities in the course of the day. And that's what the Buddha is really pointing to. And the question is, which of these identities are skillful and which ones are not? And for the purpose of the path, he says there are some times when you actually have to hold on to a skillful sense of self so that you can let go of the unskillful ones. For instance, you know, you have only so much money and you've got to feed your whole family, and at that point the idea, your identity as a cheesecake desirer has to be put aside because you've got other things need to be done with the money. And a lot of this has to do with our ability to negotiate among these various selves that we create, because sometimes the cheesecake is saying, I'm just nothing but. You know, they say like an alcoholic goes into your house and they know pretty quickly where you keep the booze in the house, because that's the important part of their identity that they're really holding on to. And if you find that you have various selves inside you that are in conflict, the question is, how do you create some order there? How do you get past the unskillful ones? And a lot of it has to do with, you know, what in Western psychology is called healthy ego functioning. And it turns out the Buddha teaches this. It's nothing new, the idea that you have to create a skillful self. The Buddha himself taught this. He talks about yourself being your mainstay. This, who else can you depend on, really, if you can't depend on yourself? That's one type of self he recommends. Another type of self, when you look at the different types of selves you have on an ordinary basis, there tend to be two kinds. There's the self as the consumer, in other words, the self that wants to have happiness. And then there's the self as the producer, the self that says, well, I have these abilities, I can do this. And you identify with your abilities. I mean, if you develop certain skills, Brock is a carpenter. And there's a lot of Brock in there. That's, you know, the carpenter Brock. Okay, and there's times when you can use your carpenter skills in order to create the happiness that you want. Now, there are other issues in life where your skills as a carpenter are not going to help at all. And for that, you have to have another range of skills. And again, we tend to identify ourselves with our skills and our set of skills. A lot of problems with addictions is that people have a very narrow set of skills. And one of the ways you can treat them is basically teaching them new skills, new ways of finding happiness, that they feel, okay, I actually do this and I can actually get good results of this. I don't have to go back to my old addiction. So a lot of this is yourself is created around your sense of skills. This is the self as a producer. Now, the Buddha recommends that we take both of these senses of self, the self as the consumer and the self as the producer, and we can use that to motivate ourselves in the path of practice to the end of suffering. For example, the self as consumer, there's one passage where the Buddha says, if you feel that you're going to give up on the practice, you can ask yourself, well, why did I start this practice to begin with? I wanted happiness, right? If I give up on the path, do I really love myself? Do I really honor that desire for happiness? So you're taking yourself as a consumer seriously. You really want a genuine happiness. This is why you're here. As for the self as a producer, there's one point where he says, if you're getting discouraged in the path, you can ask yourself, well, there are other people out there who have been able to follow this path. They can do it. Why can't I? I've got the potentials, well, the same potentials that they had. Why can't I do this myself? That's taking yourself as a producer, as, you know, take it seriously. I've got these abilities. Why can't I use them in order to find something more than just cheesecake and pizza? You know? And what I find interesting is when psychiatrists here in the West talk about healthy ego functioning, they list five functions of a healthy ego. And it turns out there are parallels in Buddhism. In Western psychology, they talk about anticipation, which is your ability to see that there are dangers down the way that you've got to prepare for. Now, if you have a very weak ego, you feel like you don't have the ability to do that, or you get apathetic and you don't care. But if you have a strong, healthy ego, you say, okay, there are things out there, the dangers I've got to prepare for, I have the ability to prepare, let's work on getting prepared. That's called anticipation, i.e. you anticipate dangers down the way. The second function of a healthy ego is altruism, seeing that your happiness will not last if it's going to depend on someone else's suffering. And so you have to help take other people's happiness into consideration when you're planning your plans for how you're going to find happiness. A third healthy ego function is suppression. Now, this is different from repression. Repression is when you've got some desire that you deny to yourself. You pretend it's not there. Now that just basically goes underground and turns into the thing. Did you see that movie? You know, where it just goes and comes up and, you know, it infects somebody else and bites somebody else and whatnot. That's what happens to a lot of your repressed desires, is they just go underground and suddenly start biting you and the people around you eventually. Suppression, however, is you know you have this particular desire, but you also know that it's going to be bad down the line if you give into it, and so you learn how to say no. And you can learn how to say no effectively. That's healthy suppression. Unhealthy suppression, again, is denying it's there, or just clenching your teeth and saying no. But healthy suppression is when you figure out, okay, how can I get around this so I don't give in to this desire? You learn how to strategize. One of your best strategies is something called sublimation. That's the fourth healthy ego function. This is your ability to find happiness, channel that desire into a healthy direction. I was trying to think of an example right now, and the only one that comes to me, they say that most business executives are sociopaths. They've done a study that most successful businessmen have a sociopathic personality. And so this is one way of channeling it, you know. And whether you think this is actually good for us, I'm beginning to wonder myself. But people who are frustrated and they become great artists, or people who have frustrations in one area of their lives and they become really dedicated, say doctors or something. That's called good sublimation. You take your desire to excel, say, and beat other people, and you say, oh, I'm going to excel as being a good surgeon, or I'm going to excel as being a good accountant, or whatever your occupation may be. And then the fifth healthy ego function is having a good sense of humor. And the humor here is not sort of nasty, sarcastic humor. It's more the kind of good-natured humor when you can look at your mistakes, look at your weaknesses, laugh with yourself in a good-natured way so you don't get dragged down by your weaknesses. And you can actually step back from them. If you can laugh at them, it helps you get past them. So you've got five healthy ego functions: anticipation, altruism, suppression, sublimation, and humor. Now, when you look in the Buddha's teachings, you find he teaches the same five functions. He calls them by different names, but they're basically the same five things. Starting with anticipation, he calls this heedfulness, your ability to see, okay, there's dangers down the line, but you have the ability to prepare for them, and you can do something to counteract them. And actually, he says this is the basis for all skillful qualities. He never says that, you know, we're naturally good as people. He never says we're naturally bad. What makes us skillful in our lives is seeing because there are dangers that have to be prepared for, we develop the skills in order to prepare for those dangers. So that's the first healthy ego function. Second one, altruism, the Buddha calls compassion. You know, seeing the suffering of other beings and being moved to want to help. There's a passage in the canon which gives kind of the Buddhist take on why you would want to feel compassion for others. And it's one of my favorite passages. There's a king, his name is Bhasenadi, and he's in his private apartments with one of his favorite queens. And in a tender moment, he turns to her and says, "Is there anyone you love more than yourself?" And you know what he's anticipating. "Yes, Your Majesty, I love you more than I love myself." I mean, after all, he's a king, you know. But his queen, Malika, she's sharper than he is. And she says, "No. There's nobody I love more than myself. And how about you? Is there anybody you love more than yourself?" And the king has to admit, "No, that's not the case." So it didn't have the story didn't have the Hollywood ending that the Buddha that King Bhasenadi anticipated. So he goes down and sees the Buddha and tells the Buddha what happened. And the Buddha said, she's right. You can search the entire world and you will never find anyone that you love more than yourself. And at the same time, you will find that everybody else loves themselves just as fiercely as you do." Now, this sounds like kind of a dog-eat-dog world, but the Buddha's conclusion is different. He says, as a result, you should never harm anyone else. Again, because if they really want their own happiness, they love themselves. If your happiness depends on their suffering, they're not going to stand for it. They're not going to stand by. "So isn't it wonderful that so-and-so is enjoying himself or herself?" They'll do what they can in order to end whatever happiness you have. So if you want a happiness that's going to last, you have to take other people's happiness into consideration. So this is the basic motivation for compassion. The third one, suppression, the Buddha calls restraint. In other words, seeing that something is unskillful, you learn how to say no. And he says, this is a function of your discernment. And you learn how to strategize. You don't just push things down and say no. Like, for example, when unskillful thoughts come into the mind, he actually has five different categories of techniques you can use. The first one is you simply realize that this is unskillful, and you're already on board with the idea that you want to do something skillful, and so all you have to do is just move your mind to another topic, and that's the end of the problem. If that doesn't work, he says, then you try to think of the drawbacks of that kind of thinking. If you were to continue thinking that way for another 12 hours, what kind of behavior would it lead to? Or you can just see the fact, if you're meditating and you suddenly find one of your old films coming back, these old videos that you tend to go over and over and over again. One thing that I do with myself is ask myself, okay, would I pay money to watch this film? If we're even free on TV, would I want to watch this? This is, in Thai they have a phrase for stories that you know where they're going to go and the acting is horrible, and they call them stagnant water stories. And so we have a lot of stagnant water films in our mind. So if you look at the drawbacks of that kind of thinking and you realize this is not where I want to go, that's another way of going past it. The third one is simply ignoring the thought, i.e. allowing it to be there, but you're not going to get involved. It's like a crazy person comes up to you and starts talking. You know, if you turn to drive the crazy person away, they've got you involved in the conversation already. And then you get more and more ensnared in the crazy person's way of thinking. However, if the crazy person comes up and you just kind of turn away and they'll say really crazy, crazy things to get your attention, but you're firm, I'm not going to give them any attention, after a while they go away. This is the same way you can deal with some thoughts. You just, let them go through the mind, but I'm not going to get involved. And then after a while, through your lack of attention, they go away. The fourth method is realizing that when you're thinking a thought, there has to be tension in the body someplace in order to keep that thought in mind. Where is the tension for this particular thought? If you've been doing breath meditation, especially the whole body kind of awareness breath meditation, you'll notice where that tension is and you can let it go. That's the fourth method. It's only if these other methods don't work that the Buddha uses basically the sledgehammer, i.e. I'm not going to think that thought. Just kind of crush it down. In the forest tradition, they teach that you take a meditation word, just repeat it really, really, really fast. In the same way they used to jam Radio Free Europe, you know, they'd send other frequencies out. So you just say, you know, and if your meditation word is Bhutto, it's just Bhutto, 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 Bhutto. And after a while, the mind gets tired, and by that time it's tired, it's too tired even to think the thought. So there are actually five different strategies you have. But of course, all these strategies will work only if you want them to work. If part of the mind says, you know, I really like thinking about cheesecake, and I'm not going to think about anything else. Okay, then you have to turn on that voice. It says, okay, why do you want to think about this? What are you getting out of this? And you have to deal on that level. And the Buddha said there are basically four kinds of action in the world. They're the actions that you like and you know they're going to give good results. And the actions that you don't like to do and you know they give bad results. In those cases, those are no-brainers. If it's good, you like to do it, you're going to do it, no problem. If it's not good, you don't like to do it, and you know it's going to give bad results, you're not going to do it. The ones that are hard are the ones that you like doing, but you know that they're going to give bad results, and the ones that you don't like doing, but you know they're going to give good results. That's where you have to use your wisdom and discernment. So that all of that goes into restraint. The fourth function, sublimation, is finding happiness. The Buddha discovered that most of us go for sensual pleasure because we don't think that there is any other alternative to pain. And one of his major discoveries in the course of his awakening was that there is an alternative pleasure that isn't even deathless yet. It's not at the end of the path. There's a means on the way, which is to get the mind in a good state of concentration. What he calls jhana. You get the mind firmly in the body with a whole body awareness like we were working on earlier this evening. There can come a strong sense of pleasure from that when you learn how to do it well. And when you have that pleasure that you can tap on, it makes it a lot easier to say no to unskillful urges and things that would pull you off to do something you know is not right. So you don't just say no to yourself, you say, okay, no over there, but here's a really nice yes over here. Let's go in for this sentence of pleasure. Finally, for humor, the Buddha doesn't talk much about humor, but there is a fair amount of it in his teachings, if you know where to look. And it's not kind of sarcastic or nasty humor, it's just more the very good-natured humor. Sometimes it can be quite biting, but it's basically there to have you look at your own defilements. Many of these humorous stories in the canon are in the section that's called the Vinaya, which is the monk's rules, which is probably why most people don't know about the humor of the canon, because nobody reads the monk's rules. Everyone thinks it's all dry. And all the really racy stories, however, in the canon are in the monk's rules. You know. Some really nice ones. Neither the examples tonight are going to be racy. There's a book in the back. It's called The Buddha Smiles. It's about the humor in the canon. There's one story about a monk who had psychic powers, and he was able to defeat this fire-breathing serpent using his psychic powers. And word gets out, and the lay people in the city want to make merit with him, so they go ask the monks and say, what do monks really like that they don't usually get for on their alms? Well, they ask the wrong monks, and the monks say, we don't get any hard liquor. You know? And so the next morning, this monk, the one with psychic powers, his name is Saketa, goes to the city, and every house he goes to, they have a little glass of hard liquor for him. So he takes the hard liquor, and he passes out at the city gate. And so the Buddha comes along with some monks and sees him, and they say, okay, let's take him back to the monastery. So they carry him back to the monastery. And he gets back there, and they lay him down on the ground and with his head toward the Buddha. And the Buddha's giving a Dharma talk, and Saketa's kind of tossing and turning and tossing and turning. He finally ends with his feet toward the Buddha. And the Buddha says, in the past, didn't he show respect to us? Yes. Does he showing respect to us now? No. And in the past, didn't he do battle with that fire-breathing serpent? Yes. Could he do battle with a salamander now? No. That's why we have the rule against monks taking alcohol. There's another one where there was a monk who was assigned this particular time to give instructions to the nuns. And the nuns hear that he's going to be giving the instructions, and they talk to themselves first, and they said, this instruction is not going to be effective because this monk knows only one verse of the Buddha's teachings, and that's all he's going to do is going to repeat it over and over and over again. But they go, and they get there, and he goes through the formalities at the beginning of the instruction. He says, okay, here's today's instruction. And he starts repeating this verse again. And the nuns turn to one another and say, didn't we say so? This is not going to be effective. And so he hears them. Well, it turns out there's more to him than just the one verse. He's got a lot of psychic powers. So he levitates up into the sky, divides himself into many different monks, and some of them are emitting light, and some of them are emitting smoke, and some of them are emitting water, and they're all saying different versions of the Buddha. And the nuns are saying, wow, this is the most effective Dharma talk we've ever seen. So he gets carried away, and so he does this until nightfall. And then he dismisses them. Well, they try to go back into the city where the nunnery was, and the city gates are locked. So they have to spend the night outside the city. Then the next morning, as the city gates get opened, the nuns come in, and the people say, oh, here are the nuns coming in for spending the night with the monks out there in the forest. So there was a rule now that monks are not allowed to teach nuns after dark. So those are some of the examples of humor in the canon. And there's one more. The Buddha has a comparison between Brahmins and dogs, and the dogs come out better. For example, in the past, Brahmins didn't handle money. Dogs didn't handle money. Nowadays, Brahmins handle money, but dogs still don't handle money. You know? In the past, Brahmins didn't mate with non-Brahmins, and dogs didn't mate with non-dogs. Nowadays, Brahmins do mate with non-Brahmins, but dogs still don't mate with non-dogs. It goes down in that vein. So what you have here are the five healthy ego functions are being taught by the Buddha as ways of developing that skillful sense of self that is going to help you on the path. Because you need to have the conviction that you can do it, and you need to have the desire, okay, it's this worth it to put all this effort in, because the happiness I'm going to get at the end is going to be worth it. You need those two senses of self as a producer and as a consumer to keep you on the path. And these five functions help both with the producer and with the consumer. Like heedfulness reminds the producer, okay, you've really got to work on it. And it also reminds the consumer, okay, if you want a true happiness, you want happiness is not going to let you down, you've got to work on the path. And same with all these other functions. They help both the sense of train yourself as a skillful producer and as a skillful consumer. You will eventually get to the point at the end of the path where you really don't need these things anymore, these functions. Because after all, what is your self function anyhow? It's because it's around the desire for happiness. Again, it's the producer, I can produce the happiness, the consumer, I'll have some happiness to consume. When you reach the end of the path, there's this deathless happiness that doesn't require anything to produce it, and there's no concern about who's consuming it, it's just there. That's when you totally let go of your sense of self. Now you notice here the Buddha's not saying that you just kind of let go and go with the flow. I mean, you let go because you found something that's beyond the flow, something that is not going to change. So it is correct that when the Buddha was talking about the question of not-self, it's more an issue of psychology as opposed to an issue of metaphysics. But his psychology is based on one metaphysical issue, which is that your happiness and your suffering depend on your actions. The fact that your actions have that power, that is a metaphysical issue. Because you have the choice to make these actions or not. You have free will, basically. And your actions really do have an impact. Based on that, then the question is, to what extent is the concept of self helpful for true happiness, and when is it harmful? And it really depends on what kind of self you're developing. So you develop, instead of the question of, okay, if there is no self, then what does the actions? In other words, putting the issue of self first and then karma second, it's the other way around. The issue of karma comes first. People have actions, you're acting right now, you're making choices right now. The question is, when is it skillful, and what particularly, when is a concept of self skillful, and what kinds of self are skillful. And this list of these five functions can give you an idea of when your sense of self is actually being helpful and when it's getting in the way. So that eventually at the end of the path, then you're not going to need any of these functions. You can still use them. I mean, the Buddha still used his sense of humor, and he still used his ability to practice jhana. But at this point, this was all for the purpose of teaching other people. His own issues were taken care of. So this is, so the wisdom of the ego is actually a very important part of the path. You need to develop this sense of self. I don't know how many times I hear people say, "Well, I don't want to have a lot of ego," or "Isn't it having a lot of ego if you're going to sit there for an hour or two?" Or sometimes when you need to get some encouragement in the path, you say, "Well, I may not be meditating very well, but at least I'm meditating. Think of all the people out in the world not even meditating at all." And someone will say, "Well, isn't that building an ego?" I said, "It's an ego you're going to need at that point, just to get you encouraged to practice." So learn how to use your sense of ego in a skillful way, and it actually is an important part of the practice. So that was what I had to say. I said it in half an hour. So, are there any questions? Any comments? Well, you don't have to focus so much on the ego formation, but if you find it difficult to think thoughts of goodwill, you might have to say, "Hey, look, you know, I need this." Because when we're spreading thoughts of goodwill, the Buddha's first point is that, okay, you need this goodwill, because you have to learn how to depend on yourself when you're out there dealing with really difficult people. How can you trust yourself not to do unskillful things to them? And if you say, "Okay, I've got goodwill for these beings, I don't want to cause them suffering, I don't want to cause them harm," you've got to keep that in mind. And so you develop that, you work on it. Now, if you think, "I'm up there sort of giving nice metta to all these poor people down there," that's very unhealthy. That's a very unhealthy way of doing it. You know? Thoughts are actions. They are kind of karma. In fact, of course, your physical actions come from your thoughts, which is why the Buddha said that, you know, intention is the karma. And he makes a distinction not only between good intentions and bad intentions, but skillful intentions. Because we know that's the old phrase, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Because you can wish somebody well, but you can be really stupid about how you carry it out. This is where the issue of skillfulness comes in. You learn how to do this skillfully. That's what you learn from trial and error, is trying to work on good intentions and actually seeing what are the results I get, then learning from that. Bruce, you're making a face.
I am. There may be a sense in which, the thing I heard you say that struck me the deepest was that karma comes first and the doctrine of self comes second. There may be a sense in which Western philosophy reverses mm-hmm. everything mm-hmm. from the Buddha, which takes us directly into the Western romantic tradition, mm-hmm. which you just wrote a book about. Mm-hmm. So how does Western romanticism reverse what the Buddha is teaching?
Well, basically, it's for them, the big issue in religion is your relationship to the universe. And the answer, that's the question. What is your relationship to the universe? And the answer is that you are one with the universe. Now, the Buddha doesn't answer that question at all. The one time he was asked, "Is the universe one?" He said, "No, I don't answer that." Is it a multiplicity of all kinds of things? He said, "I don't answer that one either." And his question is always, what's causing suffering? What can we do to put an end to it? So that's where it's a different issue. Because he says you can get your mind into states of oneness, but they still are not the end of suffering. So he's got to go beyond.
Driving over, I was thinking about the conversation, the arguments about the doctrine of God, the doctrine of the world, the doctrine of salvation, mm-hmm. the doctrine of and all of those, the Buddha would say, are not useful questions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is why he told his monks not to get involved with the debates. Because when you're in a debate, somebody else is setting the question, and you've got to give an answer. And if you don't give an answer, you lose. Whereas in the Buddha's case, people would come with questions. He said, that's not a question I'm going to ask. And then he would answer, and then he would give his reasons. It's the person who's in control of the questions, they're the ones who control, basically control the discussion. Now for him, his purpose in controlling the discussion is that these other questions just really get in the way of the issue that he really wants to solve, is teach you how to put an end to the suffering you're causing yourself. Well, it's something of being trained. In other words, for most of us, it's like we have a bureaucracy. We're kind of at the top, and the middle level is doing all the decisions, and occasionally they'll send word up to the top. And as a meditator, you want to get down into the middle level and then see, okay, what's going on here. That's if your mind is not still, you can't see this. It's kind of in the background noise, which is why we miss these things. But there are little choices that are being made there. It's just that we're not fully conscious of it. The more conscious we are of the choices being made, then the more we can exercise our free will. And if you're here for the weekend, we'll be talking about how that's actually where, at that point where choices are being made, that's how you can kind of work your way into something beyond that. Okay. Well, they'll have the recordings later on. Mm-hmm. Well, again, but then there's the choice to have the thought. Because what you've got is you've got some potentials coming in from the past, and then there's a choice in the present moment as to which ones you're going to go with. So that thought can be there, but then your choice to run with the thought or not run with the thought. And since many times we run with things that we know we shouldn't be running with, you know, like scissors, you know. And so we hide it from ourselves. Right, yeah. And because, I mean, it's not, as I said, it's not that we only are kind of ignorant of this middle-level decision. Sometimes we pretend we don't know. Like, you know.
I was thinking of Prime Minister Harper.
Yes.
So where would the click, does the ego fit into five aggregates? Does it fit in there for me, or is that
it, if you think of it more as a function as opposed to a thing? These are actions that you do, and sankhara, fabrication, would be the prime one, but there are also perceptions that go in. You know, I identify with this, I identify with that. But even the aggregates are actions. And these are functions in the mind. It's okay, what will be good for me down the line? You're asking a series of questions, you're making a series of decisions based on some perceptions and some feelings and some thought constructs. They're all kind of tied in there together. I mean, this is why the Buddha listed the five aggregates as the things you've got to get rid of your clinging to, because we tend to identify at any one time with any one of these five or any combination of them. Sometimes this is something that sometimes happens when you wish them goodwill, or do you only sometimes wish them goodwill? It's perfectly fine.
It doesn't
doesn't matter. I mean, there may come a point where you say, for their own purpose, for their own goodwill. I mean, it's like with any skillful action, whatever motivates you to do it skillfully is a good thing. And the Buddha talks about generosity, and he talks about the levels of generosity, and the lowest level of generosity is basically, you know, I want to do this and get interest back. And that's higher than that is, okay, that it goes into ascending levels. But he says still it's better that you give than that you don't give. And then as you've been giving long enough, and then after a while you say, okay, I've been thinking in those terms long enough, maybe I'm ready to move on to the next stage. But if you find that you're not ready for the next stage yet, it's okay, well, I'll stay here for the time being and contemplate it. Okay, again, the primary one is to give the person who's addicted, say yourself, an alternative thing to do. Like if there's something that you know that you want to do this evening, and they say, and part of you says, you know, if I don't do this, I'm going to die. And the rest of your mind has to come up and say, well, have you died the last time you didn't do this? No. You say, but I want some pleasure right now. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I want some pleasure right now. And this is one of the reasons why we work on the meditation as not just a noting of whatever comes up, but actively trying to give rise to a sense of ease and well-being in the body. And as you get more familiar with that, you'll begin to notice that certain kind of trigger parts of your body that you can let go of some tension there and be a nice kind of feeling will flood the different parts of the body. Learn that spot. Use it. Say, look, you're feeling fine right now. You can do this. It takes just a few seconds. You can do it. And then the impulse to give in is a lot weaker. And then you can also see, well, what was going on behind that impulse besides just the pleasure thing? But you're now in a better position to see. Consumer.
Consumer. So would the producer be the more to do with the action?
Mm-hmm.
And then the consumer kind of experiencing the result of that action?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So and it sounds like a lot like karma.
Well, it's kind of like karma. I mean, there's the actor, but in the sense of self is specifically around you have certain skills. And if you want to change your sense of self, you change your range of skills or expand it to be more skillful. But yeah, it comes down to the actor and the receiver, basically. Yeah, well, there comes a point where you say, this activity is not worth it.
Yeah.
Whatever pleasure I'm getting out of it is not worth the harm or the suffering that I'm causing. And that's kind of the basic calculus that allows us to let go of something. And so, and the Buddha has you use that calculus as you're on the path, because a lot of things that we're attached to is we get something out of them, and we turn our blind eye to the harm. And he wants you to say, okay, look at the harm that you're doing here, and to the point where you say, yeah, I really don't want to do that anymore. And you leave it.
Same thing when I was older.
Mm-hmm.
It just became an obsession.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I realized that it was
wrong. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What did you start doing instead? My sister-in-law has a New Yorker cartoon on her refrigerator. These two couples sitting in a very posh New York restaurant, and they all look very stylish. And the woman in one couple turns to the woman in the other one and said, "Did I ever tell you about the time we almost went bowling?" That's enshrined on her refrigerator. There's another one where two couples are sitting in the living room, and the husband in one says to the other couple, "Of course it's had its ups and downs, but Margaret and I have found the consumer experience to be a rewarding one." So look at what you're consuming and look how you produce it. Well, a lot of times just doing the activity of the producing becomes your pleasure. Yeah. And you don't really stop to think about what is the consumer at the end, because I enjoy the activity while I'm doing it. So the consumer and the producer are going together right there. Is that it for the evening? Okay. Yes?
I have one thing I wasn't quite sure I understood that you said when you were asking, where you were referring at one point to Jonathan, and the pleasures that can be inherent in that, which is, which sometimes seems like it's really close to your, that feeling of wonder.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I mean, concentration is something that you do, and because it's dependent on your actions, it cannot be permanent. It's something that's fabricated. So you use it as part of the path, and that's the whole Buddhist approach, is that you're actually using actions, using fabrications, in his term, to get to something that is unfabricated. And it's not like it's going to cause the unfabricated, but it's the road to get you there. And so there will come a point where you see, okay, your attachment to this, it's a better pleasure than your other ones because it's less blameworthy and it's more available. But you still have to keep it going. The question? And there's a better happiness than that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And because the mind is still there, you can begin to see the other possibilities. You're not going to see the other possibilities without having gotten it still and secure in that state. So it's a necessary step. Mm-hmm. Yes?
So is there a point where you drop the healthy ego, or mm-hmm. do you always continue to have it?
Well, it's the kind of thing you pick it up as a tool when you need it, when you put it down, when you don't. Because the whole purpose of having a sense of self is that you are looking for happiness, and you, again, there's the producer and the consumer, but the happiness of the deathless, or the goal that we're talking about here, is something that doesn't need to be reproduced or be consumed. It's just kind of there. Now, as long as you're in touch with that state, you don't need any of these things, so you drop them all. But when you're dealing with other people, you've developed these habits, you've developed these skills, and you put them to use. Mm-hmm. So it's there when you need it, but you don't have to carry it around. It kind of floats behind you. It doesn't have to. And the Buddha said if we had to wait until all our karma was dealt with before we could awaken, then the awakening would never come. And what happens instead is that He says that, you know, your actions give rise to certain tendencies, but it does. It's not like karma is tit for tat. You know, you killed five people, and then you have to get killed five times before you're going to gain awakening. It's not that. It's not that way at all. Will you be here for the weekend? Okay, we're going to be getting into some of this, but it's, you don't have to wait until all your karma has been burned off and then gain awakening. But for final, you know, the final nirvana of an arahant, okay, that's that point where his or her karma has been basically dealt with, and then they can go, you know, enter total nirvana. And some people have a lot, you know, some people have a pretty heavy load, and this is why there's a belief in Thailand, you would notice that some of the forest ajahns have lots and lots of psychic powers. And the belief is, well, they have lots of people they have to repay. And psychic powers are a very efficient way of doing that. I'm sure that raises a lot of questions. Well, there was one ajahn who was famous for the fact that you could take anything that he had been, like his betel nut, if he'd been chewing his betel nut, and you could ask him for it, and he'd give it to you, and you would take it, and it would cure your disease. Okay, he's paying off some pretty heavy karmic tax right there, but just by giving away his betel nut. Yeah. And as he used to complain to my teacher, he said, you know, just as the betel nut's beginning to taste good, someone's coming and asking for the betel nut. But that's quite a small price to pay. Okay, well, thank you for your attention. And for those of you here this weekend, look forward to continuing it tomorrow.